Hey, up and welcome to another episode of the Edge of Futurist podcast. It's a bit weird that we're actually in the same video screen and actually looking at each other. We're actually in the same room and we're wearing merch. Look at this. Look at this merch. We are not in a normal recording space because we've actually been down in the south of England for our sins. We didn't get nosebleeds. They did ask us to pay to come in through that Dartford tunnel or something. Apparently that's the tax on northern people to allow them to come into this space. But we've been involved with the Haberdashers Trust Professional Development Day today. So that's been fun. But we are very, very excited to be on another episode of the podcast. How have you been doing, mate?
Feels weird.
It does feel weird being together. Weird.
Like, I don't have to keep like muting it. I know, I'm not sure I like the dynamic. It feels weird that I keep wanting to mute and unmute myself. I'm just sitting here silently because I breathe heavy, so I have to sit away just to make sure the microphone's not.
Oh, it's getting you that's been sent no, in it's doing you, that.
You. No, I didn't want to know if it Ben. I just realised it's Ben. But yeah, it's good. It's good. It's been fantastic. It's been a long we got up mega early today, didn't we?
Yeah, 4 o'clock.
Yeah, got up early, long drive down. But you know what? What some really, really good conversations today. We had a special short snippet, 15-minute interview with somebody that we didn't expect as well. That was one of the.
I think we should tell people.
Should we say?
Might have even been ordered out by the time this goes out.
Maybe. Yeah. So we had a 15-minute conversation about the future education with who, Ben?
Dame Alison Peacock from the Chartered College, which was a very, very exciting conversation. She's the champion in the role of teachers and fighting against the system as well as much. Probably more than we are in a lot of conversations, so it's always good.
Need to change. Everybody pushing in the right direction, I think, don't we? So, but yeah, it's been good. But yeah,
it's been a strange week, hasn't it? It's been a lot busy. I've just been on holiday. You've not been on holiday.
No, I'm still as pale as ever. Ben's got a tan.
Yep.
Which is even more prominent now. I'm sitting next to him. Oh, is it? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Maybe it's light.
Maybe some lighting. There is a white background behind us. So, but we are very, very pleased to. This has been a time in the making. We got a request having a conversation with our guests for today, who have written a very, very important book. These the prolific writers. In fact, actually, I reckon in their little bio bit, it should say author of multiple books. And actually, you'll see one of them has got in the background all their books on display. One of them hasn't. But that's all right, because we forgive some people for not being prepared, and that's all right.
Yeah, and also one person has written more books than I've read, which is, it's not really a challenge, is it? But,
yeah, but Biff, Chip and Kipper, like, are you...
I moved on from that.
You moved on from
Yeah,
that.
When I got to A-level, you know, Ben, let's not go back to that difficult
sorry,
time.
Sorry. But we are very, very much looking forward to this conversation. Two authors of a great book that we've had the privilege to read early on, and so we'll bring them in. We've got Andy and we've got Matt. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Andy and Matt. How are you?
Yeah, you well? I'm good. So we were so polite there. We were both waiting for the other person to speak. yeah, I got comfortable with the dead air so early on, so I thought I'd jump in, so forgive me, Andy. Yeah, I'm good. It's good to see you, Ben and Steve, and good to see you too, Andy. But please don't... mistake the fact that I've got some books in the background and a jacket on for any kind of preparation whatsoever. I am so underprepared for this conversation.
Yeah, it's just the way we like it. So it's the best way to do it.
and Ben, I'm completely opposite. I haven't got books in the background, but I'm massively prepared for this conversation, you know, so which tells you something about my level of professionalism. And I don't, you know what I mean, compared to Matt Bromley, that just tells you everything, really, you know. So, you know.
brilliant. So Andy, give us a bit of a synopsis of you, your story, and how you got to where you are now. What give us a little bit of an insight.
Yeah, so the beginning of the book, Matt and I talk about our stories, but in a nutshell, working class kid, really. But probably I'd have my life trajectory looked like I was going to be quite middle class. My original father, he was a magician. Quite interestingly, he disappeared when I was 7 years old. I haven't seen him since. But that left us in destitution, left us in, in those days, a house was just in the man's name type of thing, which would be in the 70s. So, homeless, me mum, me brother and me, went into council accommodation. So he eventually remarried a West Indian guy called Emerson, who became my dad, and I took his surname. So his name is Emerson Griffith, the first black linesman on the Football League, by the way. So he was a football official in his spare time, worked for the post office. Sort of politicised me, I guess, having a black stepdad. Yeah, went to university. First person in my family went to university, really encouraged by my parents to do that. Became a teacher. And then 12 years into teaching, went self-employed. Not because I didn't like teaching, but I just saw it as an opportunity to be more creative and do other things. So I've been self-employed now since 2001. And you've been on some of my courses, Ben, haven't you? And you know how awesome they are.
Outstanding, outstanding teacher.
Thank you very much. But yeah, you know, I do work with students and I work with teachers. And then myself and Matt met at the end of a training day some years ago, and we made a decision over a pint to keep in touch, and then we've had other pints since, and I think written a really good book that we're proud of. You know, I'm really proud of it, and what I like about Matt's writing is, I mean, I try to be similar, he tries to be really practical, so it's not just about outlining what you see the problems are, but offering some solutions, and so yeah, it was a really good tie-up with Matt, and he's a really, really good writer, and he's made my crayon-esque level writing a lot better through working with him, you know.
Yeah, I won't make any comment. I won't be able to work out which bits of the book were written by you, Andy. There are some colouring in bits at the end.
I'm pleased with the bumblebee on page 22. That's a cracker, you know. But yeah,
I'm looking now to see if there's a bumblebee on page 22. There is a graph, though. I bet you did that drawing of the graph on page 22.
Unfortunately, we got that from another source. But a really good source, actually. I'm sure we'll talk about him in this session today. Professor Danny Dorling, who's a really, really inspirational sort of geographer and got a really lot of interesting views about why we're in such a mess in this country, really, you know. So, anyway, over to you, Matt. Go on, give us a bit of your...
Yeah, well, all I can say is I'm so pleased that when Andy talks about how we met and came together, he's always been able to say that he bought me a pint of Guinness and I still owe him that pint. Well, he can't say that anymore because I bought it back a few weeks ago. So I'm so pleased. This is the first interview we've done where he hasn't been able to make some comment about me being a tight Yorkshireman. So I'm going to take that. But yeah, very similar. Yeah, tight Yorkshireman. Very similar backgrounds, although I am from the north of England and therefore better than Andy. We sort of came from working class backgrounds. My dad was a joiner. My mum, when she went back to work, having, had me and my brother, did various sort of part-time jobs, dinner lady, cleaner, you know, very sort of typical working class upbringing, but also very proud of who we were and where we came from and of that community that we belong to. So that's always stuck with me, is that although we did experience difficulties, not least financial, we were still proud of who we are and you know, where we came from and our family and so on. But yeah, like Andy, kind of had difficulties. The school that I went to, first of all, was absolutely shocking. When I changed schools at the age of 9, I couldn't construct a sentence. Don't make any comments about my writing now, please. It's got slightly better. And so I kind of saw firsthand that those schools in those deprived areas were not of the same standard, the same quality. There wasn't equality of opportunity in education then, and there still isn't. Obviously, we'll come on to that. But again, like Andy, first in my family to go to university, I was lucky, and it is luck, that I did that at a time where there was a full government grant. Otherwise, I would not have been able to go to university. I would not have been given some of the opportunities that I have been given because of that. So we're also aware of the fact that in many ways, although society has always been divided, it's even worse today than it was when we were younger. So things are more difficult, more challenging for young people today. I would not have got where I am, for whatever that's worth, had I been on that journey now. So yeah, we've seen firsthand what it's like to come from disadvantage, what it means to not get the best start in life in terms of that education, not have the same opportunities, not have the same networks and the links, and you know, it's who you know, what not what you know, etc. We've seen that, and we've also seen what more money and some very strategic action can do to help you to overcome some of those challenges. Then in terms of my career, well, I last thing I wanted to do when I left university was to become a teacher. That was the only thing I knew I didn't want to do. I wanted to be a journalist, and that's what I attempted to do. But I had so much student debt on top of that full grant. I'd obviously taken loans, and I'd sort of accrued debt in order to pay my way through uni, despite working all the way through uni. I still had lots of debt. So I couldn't afford to go on and do the postgrad qualification that I needed to be taken on as a full-time journalist on the local paper. So after a bit of time freelancing, I just knew I had to take some paid employment. And so I took a job in a call center, and I worked in telecoms for a while. And it was only several years later, when I'd worked really hard to save some money, that I could afford then to go back to uni. But by that point, I decided, actually, I want to be a teacher, that I want to do something meaningful. I want to do what my teachers did for me when I was at school, which is to genuinely give me an opportunity in life to open doors to that sort of future success. So I went back to uni, paid my way through, did a PGCE, became a teacher. I've been in education now for about 25 years. I sort of followed a traditional path from teacher up to head teacher. I've worked in primary, secondary and FE settings. And for the last, what is it now, about 5-6 years, I've been self-employed. Obviously, the books. I contribute to a number of education magazines. I do conferences, training courses, and school improvement work as well. And my bread and butter is still going into schools in disadvantaged communities and helping, hopefully, in some small way, helping them to do a bit more for those young people who start with less. And, yeah, as Andy said, we kind of... We met having both done a training course in the same venue, got chatting, realised that we had very similar backgrounds, very similar motivations and passions, and vowed to keep in touch. And then a little bit later, we kind of came up with this idea of the book, and, well, here we are.
Love it. And to be fair, I think you've got other two more allies in that space as well, from similar backgrounds, similar stories, similar, and so it's nice to be in a room. Metaphorically, obviously, nice to be in a room with people who are passionate about, still passionate to make a difference. And you wrote this book, and in, those who are watching, you can see that in a background, in Matt's background, we've got it here. It's called The Working Classroom. And the subtitle says, How to Make School Work for Working Class Students. And the principle of the book really is about how the education system in England is not fit to make it work for working class students. It's not working equitably. You intimated that in the introduction there. So I wonder if it's worth, we can talk at that space around what, how are working class students disadvantaged by the current system? Can we start at that place to then be able to talk about what we need to do about that? How are they disadvantaged? I don't know who wants to take that first. Do you want to go into that?
You know what, Matt, you start and then I'll jump in if there's anything I think. Go on.
Yeah, okay. Well, our contention in the book is that society is not fair. It's not equal. And schools, because they're microcosms of society, they are small facets of the community they serve, are also, by definition, unfair, unequal places. And that's not just our view. There's a lot of data that supports that view. Look at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Deaton, the view of inequalities from last year, that really underline the fact that young children who start school at a disadvantage are further disadvantaged by the education system. So they become more and more disadvantaged as they travel through education. People from working class backgrounds, from socioeconomic deprivation particularly, do less well in school, so they get lower educational outcomes. They are far less likely to go on to further and or higher education and get a degree. They are far less likely to find meaningful, fulfilling employment, far less likely to earn more than their peers in later life, and far less likely to enjoy good health and well-being now and in the future. So yeah, the system doesn't work. And we set out in the book why we think the system doesn't work. I mean, one thing we cannot ignore is money. Funding is not equitable. It's not the same for all. less money is spent on working class students than their more advantaged affluent peers. And as we've seen from the work of Danny Darling, which I'm sure we'll come back to, I think Andy will probably touch on that a bit later, money does make a difference. It makes a really significant difference. We saw it in the New Labour government in the late 90s when more money was spent in education to get more working class students to university. It worked. So yeah, money, we can't ignore that. But what we've tried to do in the book is, yes, we say, look, it is systemic, it is societal, and there's bigger fish to fry here to try and change the way the system works. We wanted to focus predominantly on what is in the control of teachers and school leaders. We wanted to give people some tools, some strategies, as Andy said, some really practical things to do. So in terms of, I'll sort of headline it briefly, but in terms of what we say are the causes of this inequality of, well, we are quite bold and say it's classism in education. We've got curriculum design. So the content of the school curriculum is not fair because it's not representative of the school body, of the community. It tends to be that content selection is made by white, male, middle-class politicians. And therefore, it doesn't... This notion of the best that has been thought and said that's in the national curriculum, the Matthew Arnold quote, what is the best? It's a value choice, but by and large, that choice is made by privileged people. And so it tends not to include much of working class culture, much of working class heroes and backgrounds and so on. So it doesn't, therefore, talk to the lived experiences of working class students. And the same is true of others, black and ethnic minority students, of LGBTQ plus students and so on, who don't often see themselves reflected in what's being taught in school. And so therefore think it's not for me. School is not for me, doesn't include me, doesn't talk to me, so I'm going to switch off. Or as is happening now in large numbers, I'm not going to attend. We've got this attendance crisis, which is linked to this, inextricably linked to this. So you've got the content of the curriculum is one issue. The other is coverage. What tends to happen is that, and perhaps less so than was the case a few years ago, but what tends to happen is students who come from socioeconomic deprivation, working class kids, because they lack some of that cultural capital, problematic term, but we'll use it for now, because they lack some of that, that cultural capital, some schools think they are less able or lower performing because they don't have the background knowledge that their peers have. And so they dumb down, they reduce the curriculum for those students. And so one of the issues is that it's not giving students access to the same ambitious curriculum, the same broad and balanced curriculum. So coverage is an issue as well as content. The second issue is assessment. The way in which students are assessed in schools is also classist. The first issue there is one of what we call the home advantage. So more and more students are expected to do work at home, homework, coursework, controlled assessment, whatever it might be, independent study. They're expected to do more at home. But of course, it's harder to study at home if you live in a cold, damp, cramped flat without broadband internet, without a parent who is present and able and willing to help you. So we further sort of perpetuate these existing differences and disadvantages the more that we expect students to do outside of school. So that's one. Also, in terms of assessment, you've got the content of exam questions, which it's quite widely known. It's been in the news. It's pretty much in the news every summer that the questions that are set, certainly at GCSE and A level, they privilege the already privileged. So there was one that always sticks in my head as an English teacher. A couple of years ago, GCSE English language question explicitly advantaged students with first-hand knowledge of foreign travel. So those who hadn't been able to go on holiday and certainly not abroad were disadvantaged by that question. They couldn't compete with their peers. So that's another. The third aspect of assessment is the way in which we measure outcomes. And all I need to mention there is Askell's Forgotten Third Commission, because I'm sure everyone watching this is aware that the system is designed to fail a third of students every year. And predominantly in that bottom third are working class kids. And then the third and final aspect, the issue of classes and why schools aren't working for working class students, is one of the hidden curriculum. Andy and I talk a bit about public schools in the book. We say that we're a bit jealous in some ways about the money they've got, the resources they've got. I mean, I don't think we agree with the system because it, again, perpetuates differences. But what a lot of these privately educated students get access to is a secret knowledge, is that network of people, is about mannerisms and discernment and sometimes and a sort of a language, or even sometimes just something as simple as an accent, that often we mistake in this country as being synonymous with ability. That because you have that plummy voice and you know how to hold a knife and fork and which side to start eating at, that you somehow are more able and therefore more worthy of opportunities. But of course, that's not true. So what we also think is an issue is that hidden curriculum, that access to secret knowledge and opportunities and networks that are not equitable. So those are the issues. I won't say more at this point, but obviously in the book, we then turn our attention quite quickly to what can we do about those things? What tangible, practical things can schools do to overcome some of those systemic issues in our system?
And adding to that, I'll try and be brief, is that I think that there's a lot of language within education. I think education generally is quite middle class. I don't know what you think, Ben, Steve, but I think it's quite a middle class profession. There's unconscious middle class bias. I think a lot of the time people feel they're doing the right thing and they want to do the right thing to help working class kids. But actually sometimes what they do just makes working class people feel unwelcome and feel, not proud of being from working class heritage. So I think we need to have more of a language around working class assets. And like Matt said, you know, let's celebrate working class heroes, let's celebrate working class talent. Let's not see culture as something that's just high culture. And one of the things we're really, really clear on in the book is we say no class is an island. We're not having a go at middle class people, not even having a go at the elite. We're having a go at the elite within the elite, but we're not. But what we're sort of saying is as a society, you're richer for the more diverse people in your life, the more diverse experiences you have. So I just think there's lots of things, not just the qualification system, but even things like the way oracy is being taught now. I don't know what your views are on that, but I've got no problem. And I teach oracy, I do train on oracy around the country, and Matt does as well. I've got no problem with finding ways to help widen kids' vocabulary and help them to access to be able to sort of speak in a different register. But you mustn't associate, standard English or received pronunciation RP with something that's better than your culture. Do you see what I'm saying? So I think generally there's a lot of language in education which is a deficit model. Ofsted are built on a deficit model. That's closed this gap. That's improved this. And I think really what you should be doing sometimes is valuing what you've got in front of you. And I know that a lot of working class people in society feel a lot less pride than they used to, because I feel that, it's almost there's something wrong in being working class, So I think that when you've got an industry dominated by middle class people, which is what education is, sometimes you can try to sort of think, right, this is going to help that working class person. Even the language of social mobility sometimes implies the working class is something to get out of, So I think Matt and I try to, I think it's the first two chapters, Matt, isn't it? We construct the sort of, like, here's what we see as the problems. Two-thirds of the book are solutions, case studies, things you can do, which bring the working class with you rather than it's something that it's done to. And there's too much of that in education in general, I guess,
Yeah, I've been, have I been out 2 years, 18 months? A chair of governors at a primary school in Middleton in Leeds. People often say, oh yeah, top three most deprived areas in Leeds. And I was like, well, what's your definition? What do you mean by the most deprived area? Because ultimately you say that to kids and families. And what does that mean? I was like, I was brought in for the school. It was funded to be a brand new school in the middle of Middleton. I'm from probably 10 minutes down the road from it. Know the area really, really well. And they built this absolutely fantastic school. And I was proud. And we were saying about parents that sometimes single parents, sometimes guardians, you know, a lot of looked after children, a lot of parents that couldn't engage with the school previously or the trust because they were working two or three jobs as single mums. So, and I was like, what we have to bear in mind is let's be honest in terms of this community, let's celebrate that. Do you know, do we really understand the graft that mum has gone to? You know, to really have to, you know, go through two jobs and sometimes three jobs and everything else to just make sure that, you know, and then we're saying about homework. I was like, and I spent a lot of time in FE and I created, I've talked about this about a million times, something called the IMARC. So children or young people in further education, the organisation I worked in, were given this an authorised absence where they couldn't come into college, but they'd let somebody know because they were honest and said, look, I can't make it in because I've got to look after my brother or sister. I can't make it in because I've got to support mum and dad with doing a second job or myself, and I've got a young family myself and everything else. So I looked at it and I said, and they were like, you know, it's not a negative mark. I said, oh, is it a positive mark on the register this year then? No, it's a neutral mark. And I said, well, what does that mean then? Because ultimately, if it doesn't build to 100%, then you can call it whatever you want, but it's not a positive mark, is it? So I built the whole structure around IMARC to celebrate those individuals where possible, whether they could, if they didn't have access at home, they could do it later on in the week. So they had a full working week to submit some tasks and demonstrate progress in learning away from the classroom. So it didn't have to be away from the four walls of a building, but they could demonstrate during that time that they were still keen, they'd let us know. And because ultimately, if they wanted to go on to get a job, if they wanted to go to university, whatever their next steps were, the first thing that somebody would see is they didn't have 100%. They wanted 100%, but they couldn't achieve it because of some of the barriers that they'd honestly gone through, told us about, and we'd know nothing to support. So we'd gone through Ofsted and everything else, and Ofsted celebrated it and supported it. I was hoping not to get an MBE from it, but I don't think I'm from that background, so I don't think I'll probably get it. But not to that point, but ultimately I was like, how can we, let's be honest, would I have seen that if I haven't, I'm not saying I ever came from that background, but coming from a working class background and having people and friends who had young children, had gone through some different challenges that potentially a lot of people in different walks of life wouldn't have. Would I have ever considered that and really looked at it? Probably wouldn't. And Steve, these are the things where the system...
Steve, I think what you're saying is really important, and I guess the same motivation drives myself and Matt in that, you know, I don't know if you saw the COVID inquiry or some of the on the TV, some of the COVID inquiry questions. And there's a guy who was one of the government advisors. I think his name was Lee Kane, but I could be wrong. But he said that he was sitting around a table with 20 plus people in the cabinet, and he was the only one from a free school meals background. And this is part of the problem with the language of diversity, that almost... I think there's been a lot of progress. There's still a long way to go in racism, gender equality, homophobia, etc. Long way to go, but it's gone backwards in terms of class. You know, I think that having an understanding of someone from a working class background, someone who, and in fact, I think one of the insidious things that's happened in society is this, you know, this so-called myth of meritocracy. You know, Michael Sandel's book, The Tyranny of Merit, is a great book. Every teacher should read it, because what it perpetuates is the belief that whatever you achieve in life, you've achieved on your own merits. So if you're poor, that's your fault. And if you've done well, it's not to do with your parents' connections or, you know, all the advantages you've had in life, like private tutors and things like that. So people kid themselves, don't they? And while we've got a system that measures, that has academic success as the salient measure through, you know, qualitative exams. And I do love exams, don't get me wrong. I think there's a place for them. But not every student is going to play that game when they know there's no chance of winning from the outset. So I think, Steve, what you've done is brilliant. And in my own way, and I know it's the same for Matt, we're using our background to sort of go back into, not go back, but be part of an education system where we try to support people like us, really, that maybe without you being in that school, Steve, perhaps that IMARC system wouldn't have existed. So, you know, this book is a way of trying to, I guess, get some people to have more of a social conscience, And then those people have already got a social conscience. It's some ideas how you can execute that. And I wish we'd known this before, and we probably use your example as a case study in the book, although it's more secondary focused. You know, we were looking, and we have quite a number of case studies in the book from different schools where this sort of thing happens.
Yeah, and I like what Andy said there about social mobility, because this is one of the terms that we debated and wrestled with quite early on in the drafting process, because social mobility does imply lifting working class students out of the working class and into the middle class, and that's not the message we wanted to send at all. So we talk instead about social justice, about the equity, about fairness, celebrating working class culture as a part of the curriculum, celebrating their rich and proud ancestry and you know all that means to them, like you know how hardworking, how close and supportive those communities are of each other, but not allowing those roots to take stranglehold of students' opportunities, of life chances. So it shouldn't be a barrier. So that's what we really want to focus on. Is yes, we want to celebrate that, but we don't want somebody's birth to be their destiny. We don't want it to hold them back. And actually, just thinking about what you said, Steve, about attendance particularly, I've done quite a lot of work on attendance in the last year, and it's so complex. And you know, disadvantaged students, those from socioeconomic deprivation, are more than twice as likely to be absent from school than their peers. And when you look at some of the factors that cause that, you can understand why. You know, that interplay between attendance and the cost of living crisis. How many more young people live in poverty now than was the case 10, 13 years ago, and the impact that that has on their ability to attend school. So some of them are in poor quality housing, emergency accommodation, too far from their school. They can't afford the transportation to get there. Some of them live in conditions that are not conducive to sleep. They've got poor sleep hygiene, poor nutrition. They, you know, getting up in the morning is almost an impossible task, let alone in a clean uniform and on time for school. You've got mental health crisis, you've got all sorts of things that are having an impact on these communities. And we need to better understand what some of those factors are in order to you know, provide a more equitable system, I suppose. So, yeah, I'm really interested in what you said, Steve, about what you've done there on attendance. I think more needs to be done to understand why we've got this attendance crisis, particularly for disadvantaged students.
For sure, and I think it ties as well. You mentioned about social mobility. That's where I was going to go in that element of almost like something to escape from. The working class is something to escape from, and actually, for a long time, and you're challenging that conversation. But for a long time, that was I went to a grammar school, okay, but I got a scholarship to go to a grammar school, and I knew that I had the scholarship to go to the grammar school. I didn't need anybody to tell me and put a big sticker on my face, but but I absolutely knew that. And I reckon everybody else around me knew the same thing as well. Now, I know I was lifted by a brilliant new Labour policy of assisted place scheme. And that meant that I could go to this wonderful school and I had a great experience in school. But I know that when I went back teaching in a comprehensive school in Accrington, that was extremely diverse. Andy, you've been there. It was extremely diverse. There was lots of interesting characters in that space as well. One of the things that my first promotion, I was an RE teacher, and my first promotion out of the classroom was learning champion. You might remember this, Andy, learning champion for broadening horizons. So I got a big budget we had a wonderful, wonderful chair of governors at the time, Tony Cann. I've talked about him a lot of times, who owned Promethean, the whiteboard company. And so he put an extremely, very, very generous man, but built us a swimming pool, put loads of technology in the space, all these things that you'd imagine. And my role was to broaden horizons, whatever that means. So we managed to take children to a theatre. We managed to take them out for a meal, and they used knives and forks. There's more than one set of knives and forks. These things, which were all wonderful, but it never fully sat right with me, because it almost felt like I am trying to take them out of Accrington and make them forget Accrington. And I had a conversation with an ex-student. I still keep in contact with a lot of students. And one of my ex-students, who's doing very, very well for himself, he's out in Dubai and he gets to do all sorts of cool things. He put on his profile that he was from Manchester. And I went, you're not from Manchester, bud. You're from Accrington. And I said, why are you telling people you're from Manchester? Well, I don't want to tell people I'm from Accrington. I said, why? And I remember being stood in front of a group of sixth formers and saying, you might go to Oxford, you might go and live in London, you might go and live in Dubai. I remember saying this conversation, but you'll never, ever be able to tell anybody you're not from Accrington. So, and then he did, interestingly. But my point about it was that from a, every time you leave Accrington, Accrington is still part of who you are and should be who part of who you are. And part of the reason why I stayed in the town that I grew up in and taught in the town that I grew up in is because I don't want people to feel like they're not proud of Accrington. And I think, interestingly, that that idea of building cultural capital, broadening horizons, I know that that's an awkward phrase you said earlier, this idea of social mobility seems to kind of fly in the face of embracing our own identity and whatever else. I wonder if it's worth we can kind of get in that into that space about, rather than being ashamed of where you come from, rather than just feeling like you've got to get out of that, and like, how do we do that in that space? How do we manage that balance?
I'll go first on this one. I mean, I think I definitely understand that, by the way, that ex-pupil of yours. I remember I used to lie to people that I didn't live in a flat, you know, when I went to school. So I went to a comp in London, but it was three buses to get to this comp, or get to the upper school anyway. It was three buses. And for those who didn't know me, I was quite ashamed that I lived in flats. So I remember an RE lesson. So it was a state comp. So RE was just sitting around talking, I think, from what I remember. But it was something about, you know, so I understand that. I get that. So I've set up now scholars programs in a number of schools. So it's for high attaining working class students, very heavily loaded with pupil premium students in the cohort. And I've been running them in Kirby, Fleetwood, in Bootle. And I've got another one starting very soon in Bradford. You're absolutely right, Ben. It's a tricky one because within that program, you have to design experiences that take people out of their comfort zone. So the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu talks about habitus. It's those deep ingrained attitudes that we have. And again, this is another example of how curriculums change. You know, I think psychology is the biggest A-level in the country now, which is all about self. Business studies has replaced sociology. That says something about the way in the last 40 years our society changed from being much more pro-community, pro-social, to much more pro-individual. It's almost like we don't even notice it. It's almost normalized now that you should think, how do I get the best out of myself, rather than how do I get the best out of my community, out of my society. So the book challenges that and wants us to go back to those type of values. So, yeah, you know what? On the Scholars Programme, we take students unashamedly to the theatre. We take them to London, take them to universities and meet some interesting people. But we're always careful to counterbalance that with, well, let's bring in a successful working class person who's an entrepreneur, who's a graduate, who's a musician. Because I think, and I go back to what I said before about class prejudice or classism, I really think it's important that the middle class people actually value the working class more, you know. So I think I think if you're in a school, you know, if you're listening to this and you've got any role at all in building cultural capital within your school, because apparently it's everybody's responsibility now. You know, if you're the head of English in a school or maths, you've got a remit to add some cultural capital to what you're teaching them in your subject. So I think even if you're in a school where it's a predominantly middle class population, I think it's important that you're aware of really successful people who have come from not necessarily poverty, but certainly come from parents who are manual workers or single parents and things like this. So one of the things we talk about in the books, if you can't even do that, if you can't make that happen through a trip, is we talk about films, television programs, which you can, you know, watch with students, critique. I know it gets a bit of a bad press, but I think media studies is a really, really powerful, you know, subject to do that from. And so, yeah, I think it's really important that students of all classes get to see different people from all classes, interact with people from all classes. And one of the things I'm trying to achieve with the Scholars Program, and I think I've been pretty successful with that, is that we say to students, look, you don't have to go to university, but you're bright enough, but don't not go because you think you wouldn't fit in. Don't not go because you feel like a fish out of water. Chances are when you go to university, you will be made to feel like you don't fit in, and you'll be made to feel like a fish out of water, because for some people who are in the middle class, in elite classes, they don't like you creeping into that. You know, they don't like people like us coming into that space, because they see that as their preserve. So I'm quite keen on trying to get kids very early on to remove their own imposter syndrome, develop a bit of a chip on your shoulder, be an awkward bugger if you need to be. And that's the message I consistently give to the students and to their parents as well, because it's worked for me. I don't have an imposter syndrome. But it's been something that's happened in the past. But when you analyse where that came from, it came from the belief that you've built up over your life that, well, someone like me shouldn't be in that social space. So, you know, what I'm trying to do with setting up those programmes is very much trying to help to change that. But absolutely, Ben, I've got no problem them taking them to see the ballet, taking them to opera. Absolutely.
Me too.
But you've got to encounter different cultural experiences, and that includes people from non-working class backgrounds as well.
And yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? It's like we want to broaden horizons, but not at the expense of anything else. That's what we're saying, is it's not at the expense of your own experience. It's not at the expense of your own culture and class, if we want to call it that. But we can experience that. We've got to make sure that the exclusions aren't there. So you talk a lot about equity in that space, creating the space to break down those barriers towards those experiences. Is that where you're going to go there, Matt?
Yeah, it's exactly that, Ben. You took the words out of my mouth there. It's about balance. It's about making sure that students are comfortable in any situation. So yes, we need to celebrate where they come from, celebrate their culture, their ancestry, and we need that to be a part of a diverse curriculum experience. But we also do want students to feel able to code switch, to go into different situations with confidence, hold their head up high, and compete equitably with more affluent, advantaged students. I think both Andy and I talk in the book about when we went to university, that was probably the first time where we felt different. We felt actually quite acutely aware, I suppose, of our background. And, you know, people did make fun of my accent, and they made fun of, you know, my lack of what you'd now call cultural capital. And, you know, did I know how to hold my knife and fork? Probably not. And I did feel excluded, and I did start to wonder if this was for me, if this was the path I should take. Luckily, I persevered, and a bit like Andy, I'm an awkward bugger, so I'll give as good back as I get, but many others will not, and because they aren't able to do that code switching and to feel comfortable in who they are and where they come from, they may not take those opportunities. So absolutely, balance is all, in all things, is key. In the book, we to try, again, come back to the practical, to try and help with that, we come up with this idea of the four knowledge domains, which we want to embed in every school's curriculum. I won't go through the details of it, but they are, I'll just sort of headline them. The first is disciplinary knowledge. Then you've got personal knowledge, social knowledge, and cultural knowledge. So disciplinary knowledge is all about that ability to use language. It's about being able to speak, read, and write like a scientist, a mathematician, an artist, and so on, but also being able to communicate to a variety of audiences and in different ways. And so oracy is obviously key to that. And we do want, you know, schools to have debating societies so that students can build that confidence, that self-esteem, and be able to communicate and go into an interview and hold their head up high and, as I say, compete equitably with others. So yeah, I think balance is important, and giving students confidence in who they are and where they come from. But coming back to your student, Ben, yeah, I kind of understand it. I was the same. I'm from Bradford. I was ashamed of that for a long time, and probably would have, well, I wouldn't have said Leeds, Steve, because that's even more embarrassing, but I may have given a slightly different version of my past than was true. And yet now I've come to embrace that and what it meant to me and what it gave me, and you know, how it's helped me to be who I am. And the fact that I've still got, you know, all those school friends that I've known since I was 6, 7 years old is still a big part of my life. They keep me anchored as well in that kind of that background. But you go through that phase of being a little bit ashamed of where
you're from. For sure. I remember my parents having, if they ever picked me up from school, I made them park at the end of the road. Like, I went to the same school for 7 years and nobody ever came to my house, ever. I went to other people's houses and never came to mine. So I absolutely understand the principle. Maybe it was because of that that I had those conversations with my own students that said, don't be ashamed of where you've come from, because I'd gone through it. But yeah, totally understand it. I wonder if that student will one day go, do you know what? I'm going to go back and make a difference in Accrington, as opposed to that's what the hope is, isn't it, I suppose. Sorry, Steve.
No, I was going to say you sound like you're from Wakefield, not Bradford. But,
not Bradford.
Yeah, it's
at least we're on the right side of the Pennines.
Even worse, right. I guess. No, 100%. Of course we are.
I'm from the winning side of the Pennines.
Winning of what Blackburn are doing well at. But anyway,
winning
that's,
in the War of the Roses is what we're talking about.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're not talking about not at the moment, anyway.
So, obviously, you've talked about some bits. You talked about, obviously, the real disadvantage for working class students when you were growing up for many, many years, but also that gap in the current education system is growing. You talked about attendance. I did some work pre-COVID. I won't go into too much. It never happened, but the work around trying to create an online school for alternative provision children, likely open university, but for those students who were not accessing education in a full-time basis for whatever reason. Like I've said, a lot of those are working class young people. But your book really lends itself to not just these are the problems and oh, there's a massive gap here and a problem, but also focus on some real tangible strategies and practical strategies. Do you want to maybe talk to those, to how we can potentially, some practical things of not completely giving the whole book away, so nobody has to buy it, but also that thing of, you know, what are some of those nice tastes that people can then think about, oh, that's a good idea, and that's why I should really delve greater into the book.
Yeah, shall I do, we'll do the three E's, Andy, I'll start and you can come in on announcements, because you've talked about the scholars program, which fits in nicely to that. So yeah, in case you can't see the huge version of the book behind me, there you go. So on the front cover we've got the solution, basically, which is the three E's. So our solution to this issue is equality, equity and extension. So equality is about making sure that all students have equal access to the same ambitious core curriculum and to extracurricular activities. Equity, then, is about making sure that all students can access those things. So it's doing more for those that start with less. It's this view that we can give access to the same ambitious curriculum to all, but if we don't acknowledge that for some that's more challenging than others, and they might need more or different types of support, then it's not going to work. They'll just flounder. They'll just be left to fall through the cracks. So equity is then about targeted adaptations and interventions, and then extension is about what else do we do to kind of what we've been talking about here, really, about developing cultural capital and making sure that we give students access to that secret knowledge, that hidden curriculum. So very briefly on the first two. First of all, on the core curriculum, it is about designing that ambitious, broad and balanced sequence curriculum that's inclusive of all. I won't go through the details of curriculum design here, but just to come back to the important point of it being representative of our students. So they see themselves reflected in what we teach. So it's a lot about content selection, making sure that people feel it talks to them. Extracurricular activity is an interesting one, though, because that's often the means by which we do develop those that cultural capital, that wider knowledge of the world and filling the gaps in students' prior knowledge. But usually extracurricular activities are voluntary and are offered to all, but we don't really target who accesses it. So we might just assume because it's available, because it's voluntary and anyone can attend, that anyone who wants to will attend it. But of course that doesn't happen, because students who are disadvantaged tend not to join in with those activities. They, for example, might decide they're not even going to ask their parents if they can go to this extracurricular activity, because they know they won't be able to afford to do it. If there's extra equipment needed, if there's an entry fee, if there's a visit, a trip somewhere, or if it just means logistically having to get transport at a later time. It means they can't afford to do it. Or maybe they have other commitments, like they've got to pick up a sibling from school after, you know, when they finish, or they have to, they're the caregiver and so on. So they know they can't attend things outside of the normal school day, so they elect not to. So one of the things we really suggest is that schools should audit who attends extracurricular activities to see if that is representative of their school community. Are there any particular groups, cohorts of pupils who are not attending those activities? If not, why not? What can we do to target that access, not least in terms of funding it for those students? So that's sort of equity, making sure that everyone has access to the same broad and balanced ambitious curriculum and extracurricular activities. Equity then, as I said, it's about doing more for those that start with less. It's about acknowledging that those who come from disadvantage will need more and different support to help them to access the same ambitious curriculum. So there's two elements to that, broadly speaking. The first is adaptive teaching. So we talk quite a lot in the book about what that looks like in practice. So the use of scaffolding. Very quickly, the argument in the book is that we need to move away from traditional differentiation, which says we're going to give students different tasks to do and assess them differently and have different expectations. And instead, we need to say, look, we're going to give you all the same tasks. We'll assess you all the same and expect you all to achieve the same. But for some of you, we'll give you a little bit more help in order to access it initially. So the scaffolds are temporary support structures, more information on cues and prompts, coaching conversations, etc., questions that help students to access a task and then go on to compete, with the view being they help to become increasingly independent over time. And then interventions, sort of along the same lines, it's about those targeted additional support strategies that take place outside of the lesson in order to help students to access the subject curriculum. So in part that might be about building word power, filling in gaps in vocabulary and wider language and literacy skills, or it might be more targeted to that subject content, but it's about those additional input that we might need to give to some students. And then that leads on to extension. So Andy, over to you.
Yeah, so extensions we see as or curriculum enhancements really for higher attaining students, and often I think what we're trying to sort of rail against, guys, is a lot of cosmetic stuff that's been done around pupil premium. You know, mark pupil premium kids, books first, all that sort of stuff. We offer some quite meaty sort of case studies, like the Scholars Program, and we talk about how you can design that. Who should your team be? Who should your cohort be? What could that program look like? We also talk about language of co-curricular. So rightly, as Matt said, a lot of kids can't stay after school or won't stay after school. So can't we have things during school time? Can't we creatively get some kids out of certain lessons to do something that would be more meaningful? So if I tell you that, you know, I know a Catholic head teacher who teaches in a Catholic school, and those kids who look like they're getting ones and twos and RE, he's just taking them out of that. They're doing something much more useful for them, you know, which is going to help them on a pathway to an apprenticeship. I think we've got a website that goes with the book as well, and the intention is to gather even more case studies from schools that are doing really good work. We've got a school that has a cultural passport, which is a really good idea. So the idea that, bit like you'd stamp a passport as you travel to different countries, as you go to different experiences, you will have build your passport up over year 7 to year 11, or if I'm sure there's primary versions as well, but you build that, you know, you think about how you design that. When I'm feeling particularly wanky, I call myself a learning designer, depending what conference I'm speaking at, guys, but you design backwards from, like, what would be a great what would a great looking passport look like for these kids?
The pre-mortem, Andy.
Well, you know what? I should have a percentage of your income, Ben. You're nicking all my phrases now.
Yeah, that's it. I learned that from the best.
Yeah, you know. I do see myself, in all honesty, as like a learning designer, as a trainer. So I design training courses. I design journeys for people to go on, adults and students. So I'm trying to say in the book, how would you design a journey, a cultural journey for a student? What would it look like? What do you want it to look like before they leave your school? And I think sometimes because of the fast-paced nature of education. I think sometimes, I'm not saying people make it up as they go along, but I don't think they put, they use that backward design process as well as they could. So this book is an attempt to get people to sit down and say, right, for high-attaining working-class kids, what would a program look like for them that supplements their core curriculum? For low-attaining working-class kids, what interventions could you put in? How, you know, those kids are struggling with behavior management, mental health issues. So there's a lot of reflective sections of the book where, you know, we give a case study, give some ideas that are really happening on the ground, and then we pose some reflective questions. So we want the reader to take those reflective questions back to meetings, back to the senior leadership team, so they can thread it and embed it into their school.
Love it. And I think it lends itself really nicely to that space around, it's not superficial. You mentioned that. We don't want tokenism. We don't want superficial. We don't want cosmetic. We want deep change, and we want deep, use the phrase meaty solutions. And in the back of the book, there are a number of lessons, suggestions that you give to actually how you can do this. Is it seven lessons to keep this this stuff front and center? And literally, like, for those of you who haven't got this book, you're probably saying, no, that we're saying get it, but there's like tips to do it, resources to do this, how you'd structure that lesson, things to consider, the kind of questions to ask. And I really like that idea that we're trying to embed this in that space around making a real difference for educators. And we rail against the system all the time, and I know that you will be the same. But what I really like about this is that practical sense that this is for something that people on the ground can do to make a real difference. And we're really grateful. We could go on talking around this for probably hours and hours and hours. But what we always do at the end of the podcast in this most recent scene is give some quick fire questions. So we've got three quick fire questions that we ask, and we'd love to. You might say you didn't give us these as a prompt, but it's all right, Matt, because you said you didn't prep for this. So we'll see how good Andy is without prep. So the quick fire. So we'll go there. So do you want to go first, Steve?
Yep. Andy first. Future of exams, online, traditional, or scrapped?
I think the system gradually has to go to a hybrid system. I think there's a place for, certainly as a teacher that mostly spent his time teaching GCSE and A level, I used to actually enjoy preparing a class for exams. I don't really care if they are. They're written in an exam hall or online, but I do think that we've got to think a lot more about this forgotten third, this group of students who won't play the game. And we use the game metaphor a lot in our book. And you know what? Would you play a game you've got no chance of winning? Probably not. So I think we've got to find creative ways, not give rewards for nothing. But we've got creative ways to build digital portfolios, get students, a lot of our books about working class pride, but get students to be proud of what assets they've got, so they can sort of move on from 16, 18 years old onwards. And I think there's a lot of interesting work done around digital portfolios, which could be a good way forward in the future.
Can I just add to that? Because I think we saw through COVID, sorry, I know this is a quick fire, I will be quick, I promise, as quick as I can be, but we saw through COVID, actually, when we didn't have those formal exams, that the disadvantage gap got wider. So at the moment, they are the best worst option that we have. And so I think change will be slow. But as Andy says, I think we will move towards a more hybrid model, but I don't think it's going to be transformed anytime soon.
Okay. So, key skill that you think students are going to need in 2040? Matt, let's go to you first.
Okay. Oh, God. I suppose people talked about these 21st century skills, which kind of got a bit sort of lambasted, certainly on social media, because what is that, these transferable skills? I think if you look at what students have needed for the last 25, 50 years, there's not been significant change there. So I would probably say, and this is not a key skill, but it's a set of skills, I suppose, but they're going to continue to need resilience, self-esteem, communication, teamwork. I mean, those are probably the kind of fundamental skills that students need. But of course, I think this view that now you can Google it, the information's there, you know, easily at hand. You don't need to retain knowledge. I don't buy into that either. You still need to develop that background knowledge, because the more you know, the easier it is to know more. You know what you're researching and how to discern from, you know, fake news and fact if you've got that background knowledge. So I still think that fundamental core knowledge is going to be key, as well as those more transferable skills.
My two would be, I think, more and more schools should teach kids how to be healthy skeptics. I think the scientific method should be taught more in schools, and students should be taught to question authority more and question some of the beliefs that exist in society. And the second one, which very much links to our book, is that we need to go back to a time, because Britain at the moment is the bottom of the league tables for so many things. I mean, we've got more food banks and McDonald's outlets currently in our great country. So I think what we need to do, especially with climate emergency, we need to have more community-focused thinking. We need to have less people being pro-individual and more people being pro-social. That can be encouraged. But what those two things link together, skepticism and pro-social thinking, because what people got to realise is that a small group of people are deliberately creating tension between people and cause division. And actually, when people say there's not much difference between left and right, the main difference between left and right in politics is that the left is pro-community and the right doesn't want to have anything to do with community. So I just hope that we teach kids to be more sceptical and recognise actually that a lot of people, when you give them a bit of compassion, are actually good people and they're not there to steal your job. That, you know. So I think that, you know, that's what I would argue for you.
Okay, last one. Education in 50 years, what is your vision?
Well, I'll start off. I'll start off on this one. I get really depressed sometimes about education, I'll be honest with you. I think the thing that gives me hope is when I meet lots of the young people that I work with and see the talent that I work with. They just got to do it better than us, haven't they? And we've got to move to a system where there's school-to-school support. It's less about league tables. It's less about an inspectorate. You know, I've been around a long time, guys. I started teaching in 1989. I was there when Ofsted started in 1992. And some of the people that have become Ofsted inspectors, especially in the first few years, weren't even very good teachers, weren't even very good leaders. So we've got to get a school-to-school system of support. And we've got to get more international and internationalised education as well. And I think the word's called co-optition. Let's have less competition and more, you know, cooperation between schools. That's how I see it going forward.
Yeah, and actually that was going to be my first part of my answer as well. You stole that shamelessly there. So collaboration, not competition in the system. Yeah, I shouldn't let you go first, should I? Yeah, collaboration, not competition in the system, and less difference, therefore, in the system. So you don't have different types of schools that provide different opportunities, but you've got a flatter, fairer system, and that schools are, and it's what we talk about in this book, so let's bring it right back to that, they are the engine for social justice. They are the means by which, because I don't think in 50 years' time, society will, I hope it's a lot fairer, don't get me wrong, I hope we've done a lot in that time to make things better, but I don't think it will still be equal and fair. So I think schools, even more than ever at that point, will need to be those engines for social justice. They will need to be the way in which we are levelling, I hate this phrase, I can't believe I'm using it, but levelling the playing field for students who start at different points.
Love it, love it. Have you considered standing for office as a politician? No, that's
the questions you ask us. We just say what we want to say.
No, and bring it back to what you want to talk about. No, just joking.
What's important here? No. What the people of Britain want to talk about is how wonderful this book is and how you should all go out and buy it.
Yeah. So, as a kind of wrap, thank you so much, Andy and Matt. Go out and get The Working Classroom. It is a wonderful book. It outlines all the things that we've talked about and goes into so much depth and gives you some practical strategies that I think you're right when it says, Vic Goddard, who did the introduction, said that this is something that everybody should read, and I absolutely agree. They should. Who's training as a teacher should read it. It really matters. So, Andy, Matt, thanks for joining. Andy, it's good to see you again after all these many years, and great to see all the work that you're doing. So, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks to you both. Really kind of you. Thanks.